Okay.
Back in here.
So is this a good time to talk about your impressions of Duval at that time? And
well, I didn't live here yet. I was still commuting in my van from Index. And I was throwing all the gear into the car and driving to Duval. And then we'd move the gear from my car to one of the other guys' cars, or vans or trucks, whatever, and we would drive to the inside passage until one night we showed up. And the guy Gene, who owned it, that we got there. There's already another band called the Apple Blossom Ramblers on stage playing when we arrived to play. And Gene says, "Oh, you don't work here anymore." He hadn't bothered to call anybody or tell anybody, which was kind of mean. Me driving 50 miles, you know, from Index. Or I didn't drive 50 miles. I drove half of it to Duval, and then the other half with them.
Yeah.
But somewhere around in that time, the house in Index got sold out from under us. The lawyers who probated the lawyer who probated the woman who owned its will confiscated everything in that will as a fee for probating the will. And I think she might have ended up. She got wine. Her and her husband got wine and dined and flown to Lake Havasu City Resort, and they owned a couple of lots down there on that lake that hadn't had anything developed on it. I don't know whether he also got those and had to sell them or what. She ended up with the bread truck and maybe nothing else. But one day in the house, a couple of guys came by and they said they were from the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and they had inherited this house from the guy who sold it to the couple who sold it to the biker couple. And they moved back to Nebraska. He died. Lois's husband died. She stopped paying her payments to the widow in Nebraska. The widow in Nebraska stopped paying her payments to the guy in Everett. The guy in Everett died and left the property to the Seventh-day Adventists. And they came by and they
what
said...
What a surprise.
Yeah, they said, well, you know, we're a church. We can't really foreclose on two widows. We don't know what we're going to do. I said, well, if you do get to the place where you're going to sell it, I want first right of refusal. I live here, you know. But instead what happened is the lawyer bought everybody else out. Mm. The lawyer who probated the will of the last person in the chain, he bought everybody else out. Mm. And then he put it up for sale without putting a sign on it.
Mm.
He was advertising Gold Bar, and one day a couple that I knew came by and said, "Oh, we just bought your house. You know, you need to be out." And I said, "What?" You know, and I contacted the lawyer, and I said, I said, "I'd been given first right of refusal. Nobody even told me the place was for sale. That's not right." So they said, "Okay, you've got 2 weeks. Come up with $2,000. This house sold for $8,000 in 1976 with 250 feet on the Skykomish River."
Wow.
And neither my first wife, we were still not yet married, but we had a kid by then, or my family, neither family could come up with $2,000 to loan us for 25% down, and we had to give up on the deal. They only gave us like 2 weeks, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So my buddies in the band found me a place to rent up on right in the fork there, where Mountain View Road goes one way and the other way goes up to Lake Margaret.
Oh, way up. Then now you're in Duval's.
Yeah, so I was now living
vicinity.
In Duval.
Yeah.
About 7 miles outside of town.
You rented a
little
renting. House up there?
Mm-hmm. From Frank Hanold, Frank and Ruth Hanold, both of whom had been school teachers here in Duval.
Hmm.
And when I met Frank, he told me about his interview with the school board to become a teacher there. They'd sat him down, they asked him a bunch of questions, and the last question was, "How do you feel about corporal punishment?" And Frank thought about it for a minute. He thought, "Well, it's going to cost me the job, but I've got to be honest."
Either way.
I got to be honest with you. They get out of hand, I'm going to smack them. And they said, "You're our boy."
Oh, that's great.
So he was a teacher, and many people who grew up around here will remember him, I'm sure.
Okay.
And he also donated the property across the street for the Lake Margaret Fire Station.
Okay.
He owned quite a bit of property. When they sold their house, it was bought by some people I knew who were both fiddlers. In fact, they put a little sign on it that said Fiddler's Glen or Fiddler's Hill or something.
Mm-hmm.
They don't live there anymore. They may be renting the place, though. Oh, they still may own it. John and Susan Burke, that's their names. I see Susan every once in a while. She comes out here, and she's still playing music around the area as well. They used to have nice jam sessions at their house, and I went once or twice.
So you live there, and then you were
yeah, and
in
I'm
Duval.
Playing with the guys in the band. And at a certain point, they started saying, "Well, there's another guy here in town that wants to join our band, and we'd kind of like to have him join." I go, "Well, we're doing fine, you know. We don't need another guy, you know." And they said, "Well, he's old, a little bit older, and he's got a reputation. He's experienced." And I didn't know any of this reputation, so I was, you know, reluctant. So finally, he came to one of our rehearsals one time, and his name is Larry Vanover. So you've heard about him from some of these other people, probably. Maybe you interviewed. Well, you weren't doing this yet before
he
passed
away
a couple years ago.
Yeah.
But Larry, the reputation I didn't know was that he had played some with the PH Factor Jug Band, though I don't think he's on their album. And he had owned a music store down in the U District for a while. One of the rumors was that he sold Danny O'Keefe his first guitar when Danny came over from east of the mountains, wherever he was from, Yakima or Ellensburg or Wenatchee, I forget where. I don't know if that one is true, but Danny was a harmonica player that came over the hill. And actually, the guy I traded my pickup truck to was the brother of a guy who'd been in a band called Calliope with Danny O'Keefe. Just totally coincidental to this story, but Larry shows up at one of our rehearsals and listens to us play a little bit, and then he says, "Well, you guys are pretty mediocre, but I think I could make something out of you." And I was insulted enough by the approach that I just got up and I walked out, and I could hear him say as I was walking away, "Well, that went well, I think." But we were rehearsing that particular night for a street band contest in the university district that was called the Moonlight Serenade. There were 26 bands stretched out on both sides of University Avenue there, and the judges, you know, walked up and down and listened to each band, and in the end we placed third in tie with a band called the Virginia Trawlers, a couple of whom had actually played with John Burke in the Old Hat Band before that. Mm-hmm. So I felt somewhat vindicated about our mediocrity, that we had placed against that many other bands, you know. And part of our prize, and we won, there were three prizes. Each prize was money. We got the smallest amount of money, which might have been $25 or something. But the other part of the prize was we got to play live on a show called Off the Record on Kazam, which was a Bellevue radio station that right there in the middle 70s, it had been a black station before, I think. I'm not too sure what it was. But they changed formats, and they went with half the DJs were women, and they were allowing the DJs to decide what music they would play, and to a certain extent, within parameters. You'd have to say that James Taylor and Joni Mitchell were kind of the center of it, but one DJ might play a bunch of jazz, so you'd get John Clement or Charles Lloyd, and another one would play more of the James Taylor, Joni Mitchell stuff, and another one might play some rock and roll, Doobie Brothers. No, Toto. No. There's just one of the neighbors out in her yard.
Yes.
So, anyway, so when we went to play our radio show on Off the Record with Jeff Hyman, Larry tagged along and brought his jug. And at this point, the jug was an element that I thought could be an addition, a real addition to the band, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He played on the radio with us, and so I relented and agreed to let him join the band. And when he showed up at the first rehearsal when he was in the band, he showed up and we were playing a song called Amelia Earhart's Last Flight, I think, by Red River Dave McHenry. But I had gotten an electric guitar I bought for $35 from the Trading Post, which was the next business that was in where the Red Pepper is. When Silver Spoon moved across, it became a little kind of secondhand store called the Trading Post. Semi-antique store. I bought this Japanese copy of a 40s jazz guitar. It had a pickup on it. And so we're rocking up Red River Dave's song, and Larry walked in and he said, that sounds like rockabilly music to me. And I said, what did you call it? Mm-hmm. He says, it sounds like rockabilly music. And I said, boy, that's a really good name for it. I'd never mm-hmm. heard the term before. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I heard that term applied to my music, mm-hmm. I started looking for things that said rockabilly, were called rockabilly. Mm-hmm. And I discovered an artist named Robert Gordon. I got one album. I really liked mm-hmm. it, and went out and bought his other two albums. Mm-hmm. And the Stray Cats started making a little noise shortly after that. Mm-hmm. And
this was around late
70s?
Well,
Larry, 77, I think, mm-hmm. probably. Sometime in 77 when Larry joined the band.
Okay.
And meanwhile, in 75, when I still had lived in Index, I sat down one day and I decided I was going to... In high school, in ninth grade, you were given... aptitude test. You take this aptitude test.
Yes.
And then they get the result, and you go to the school counselor, and he tells you what you had your best chance for a job,
succeeding.
In the future. You know, what direction mm-hmm. to try to point you. And I scored pretty high in everything. I was not the highest in some areas, but I was probably above average in all the areas, but verbal skills was my area. So they sat me down. They handed me a book, had all the things you could do. You could be a public relations person. Mm-hmm. You could sell advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, there were all these different jobs. The last one in the book was freelance writer. Mm. And that's the one that appealed to me because nobody was going to be telling me what to do necessarily. Uh-huh. I could pick what I wanted to do, write about it, you know. That's the way I saw mm-hmm. it. Of course, freelance writers do take assignments. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know too much about that. But I had done a little writing for the school newspaper, and I had done some... layout stuff, photo layouts for the school yearbook, and I had written a tiny bit and done some paste up for the underground newspaper in college, and then uh-huh. I put together a little kind of very small underground publication of my own for a couple of issues.
Great.
Later on. So I had a little bit of experience, and mm-hmm. I sat down in my yard to write an article for the Mother Earth News, was my idea, about homemade instruments, because I'd gotten to know a jug player, and I'd gotten to know a washboard player and a washtub player. I'd learned about these instruments, and I sat down and wrote an article called Homegrown Music, and I told how to build and play a washtub bass. I told how to play the washboard, mm-hmm. told how to play the saw and the jug. And I sent the article off to the Mother Earth News. Well, it took them a year to respond, and a year later I got a letter back saying, well, we can't use it. It's not that it isn't worthy, it's just that we're so completely swamped with articles that we won't be able to use it. And so then it took me another year, that's 75, by about 77, it took me another year to try to figure out where else I could pitch the article. Mm-hmm. And it finally dawned on me that the newspapers in Seattle and in the region here mm-hmm. would be pretty much under obligation to try to help promote the Folklife Festival. Mm-hmm. But they might not have anything of their own to say about it. They might not know what to say. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I can sell this article to them. Here, build your own instrument, go down and play at the Folklife mm-hmm. Festival. There's all kinds of jamming going on down there in addition to the stage performances. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty good angle to sell, you know, to do it. So I took my article. First I went to the Journal American in Bellevue because it was closer.
You remember them.
And I took my article in, and I got to the entertainment section editor mm-hmm. And I told him what I had, and he says, I'll take it, great. I said, fantastic. And I headed for the door, and I got to the door, I turned around, I said, wait a minute, how much are you going to pay me for this? And he said, $35. He said, that's our housewife in Bellevue rate. You're not a professional writer, so, you know, we don't have mm-hmm. to think about trying to pay you a professional writer rate, $35. And I said, well, give me the story back. I said, I'm going to try a couple other places, mm-hmm. and if nobody else takes it, I'll bring it right back, and mm-hmm. you guys can run it. So then I went to the PI downtown, and the entertainment guy wasn't there. I showed somebody else, an underling, you know what it was, and told him about it. And he said, well, I'll tell the editor about it. So then I went over to the Times, because I was only blocks away from their And the guy at the time says, I'll take it. And wait a minute, now, I think the guy at the J&A was only going to pay me $10 or $15 for it. I think that's what the deal was, because $35 is what I got from the Times. Mm-hmm. But he said, we're going to have a photo to illustrate this. And I said, well, I'll stage something. And so I got a guy named Alan. I'm trying to think of his first name. I can look it up in the Mother Earth News. I knew a guy that was a photographer, and he was also had a little show on Crab Radio, which had the Larry Vanover connection that I didn't know was that Larry owned a piece of property here in Duval where they held the piano drop.
Yes.
This was another part of the reputation, yes, that I knew nothing about when he tried to join the band. But
it had already happened.
Oh, yeah. It happened a couple of years before I even moved out here from Michigan. So I didn't know anything much about it. But I got a photo taken where we're, you know, playing our instruments, and a wacky buddy of ours was pretending to play an axe like a guitar. But it was a cool picture, and I brought the picture to the editor, and he said, that's a great photo, but how do you play an axe? You didn't explain how to play an axe in the story. And I said, oh, it's a musician joke. Musicians call their instrument their axe. It's kind of a jazz musician
term.
How
you play
term.
An axe.
and so he's just making a visual joke, you know. And he says, boy, we're going to have to put that in the caption, or we'll get hundreds of letters asking how the heck you play an ass that's not in the story. So they ran it, and after I'd already agreed to all this, then I heard from the editor at the PI who said he would have paid me $100 for it. But I got $35, and I think Tom Allen, that's the photographer, I think he got $25 or $35 or $15. He got something for the photo, too. And then after the article ran in the Times, I cut it out and I sent it back to the Mother Earth News with the strongly worded article, strongly worded letter that said, you guys are pretty stupid not to be running a regular music column in your magazine, because I'm absolutely certain that all these people, it's a magazine for people wanting to move back to the land and start their little homestead and maybe get off the grid or whatever.
Yes.
I said, I'm dead certain that most of those people, or a really large percentage of them, already play music. And many of the others figure once they get established out there, they're going to also have to, you know, make their own entertainment, and they're going to want to. So you need to feed that too, you know. And as it turned out, the magazine had gotten big enough by this point in time to pay for a demographic survey. And the demographic survey was sitting on the editor's desk at the same time when my strongly worded letter, I didn't figure calling an editor stupid was a way to get the gig. I just thought, you know, they're stupid. I'm going to tell them so.
Mm-hmm.
And he fires a letter back right away saying, all right, you know, we'll do this. We'll buy this one. We'll pay you this much. It's going to be a two-page story in the magazine. We're going to give you a one-page column in every issue.
And all of a sudden you have a job.
Yeah, so now I'm a writer for a national magazine, which had, you know, 5 million readers. They had about 1.5 million circulation, and their demographic survey said the magazine got passed around and 4.5 people on average read each copy.
Wow.
So they figured they had 5 million readers. And then after I sent my second column in, I got an angry letter from this editor saying, you didn't send us enough material for 2 pages. But they had told me it was only going to be a 1-page column. They changed their mind, and they went with a 2-page without telling me. I could have certainly written more. I was trying to, you know. So they had to pad it out for the second one. And I ended up writing that column for 6 years. Every other month, 6 times a year. Anyway, so Larry was in the band, and we got some pretty cool gigs. I think you want me to talk more about Duval, though.
Yeah, so you're in the
and I'm living here
the
by
end
then.
Of the 70s, beginning of the 80s.
Yeah, well, I moved here in 76 when the house got sold in Index, and there was, of course, a pretty established community of arts-oriented hippies out here, but they had all bonded with each other in previous years over, you know, I don't know, drug rituals around the campfires at the revolution, so to speak, you know.
It had been going on.
And I had done this too, but with other people in other places. And now I have a wife and a kid.
They were part of that community.
Yeah, and I don't think I ever totally totally connected necessarily because of the lack of that with everybody here, and the fact that, you know, by the time I moved here, I didn't particularly drink.
Yeah.
I wasn't into smoking marijuana, and I was done with psychedelics and all those things, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't have the chance.
And you had a family.
Yeah, I had a kid, and my daughter was born in the house we were renting from Frank Hanold in 78.
Oh.
Also at home with a Danish midwife.
What is your son and daughter's name?
My son is Cedar Glen, which is a description of the place where he was born.
That's wonderful.
And my daughter's name is Beth Ann, which was, I think, my first wife's college roommate's name or something.
What
like
was
that.
Your first wife's name?
Her name's Mary.
Mary.
Well, she was Devono, and she married me, but she's married to a guy named, whose name is England, Norm England. So her name is Mary England now, and she's now a deputy prosecuting attorney for the city of Renton.
Okay.
After we got divorced, she went to night school, finished her degree. She had dropped out of the University of Washington. She'd gone to whatever the university is in Champaign, Urbana, University of Illinois.
Yes.
For her last year, she went to the University of Washington instead, and history was her major. I didn't realize that people who major in history are aiming to become lawyers. I don't know that I would have married a potential lawyer particularly, but she had a sister who was an artist that was living in a hippie commune, a fairly famous one down in New Mexico, which we visited at one point, and I think, among other things, she was maybe competing with this, you know, little sibling rivalry there that, hooking up with me, you know,
but
she dropped out of university. That summer quarter was her last one, and she dropped out without graduating and moved to the mountains with me. After the divorce, she took night school, she took correspondence courses. Mm-hmm. It took quite a while, and she finally finished her degree, and then she got a grant to go to law school.
Mm-hmm.
We had a house that was built for us up at Lake Marcel. We got a farmer's home loan, and I think we would not have really gotten it if it hadn't been for me. We went down there to sign the papers for the loan. It was all organized. We're going to have a brand new house built for us up at Lake Marcel.
Wow.
And the day we go to sign the papers, she admitted that she had just gotten a 50-cent an hour raise.
Uh-oh.
At her job. She was a secretary, receptionist. And the woman looked at that 50-cent raise, and she said, "Oh, you no longer qualify for the interest subsidy."
Mm.
So instead of the $160 a month payment for a brand new three-bedroom house, exactly the same house, I think, as the one straight across the street from me, instead, we weren't going to get the interest subsidy. And interest rates were like 13% at this point in time, just absolutely ridiculous. So our payment was going to jump from $160 a month to $600 a month, and we couldn't afford that. And Mary was freaking out, and I looked at the woman across the desk, and I said, "So you don't like the numbers that are on this piece of paper? Give me back the piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
We'll come back in a week." She gave me back the piece of paper. We came back in a week, and I had been padding my income figures because I was self-employed as a musician and a writer, and there were all kinds of expenses that I was allowed to write off, and on Schedule C, which I was writing off, I was giving them my gross income. I brought back the Schedule C. Man, I'd been padding the income because I thought they won't give you a house loan unless it looks like you can afford to pay.
It's the other way.
You know, and this 50-cent raise ticked us into a whole different category. It made the whole thing, you know. So I came back. I had my Schedule C, and I said, "Look, here's my net income. Let's use that number instead of the gross income." And of course, now we're qualified for the interest subsidy of the 13% interest. And the house came down for $160 a month. But by the time it was finished being built, I never got to live in it. Mm-hmm. I was living in the house that we rented from Don and Pat McKenzie up there at the corner. Well, the property was 40 acres on the corner of Big Rock Road. Don was trying to develop that property for what it is now, but he didn't have enough money in the end, and loans from siblings, and he ended up having to sell it to Safeway, and they did the developing. Mm-hmm. They moved Big Rock Road over. Big Rock Road now goes right down where the driveway was in front of the house that I lived in for 16 and a half years, and the house was sitting right where the driveway between Starbucks and Jiffy Lube.
So instead of the building the house, or instead of living in the new house at Lake Marcel, your marriage kind of fizzled then.
Yeah, she moved into it, and she had the government subsidy, so her payment was $160 mm-hmm. bucks a month. I was renting for $300 a month.
Mm-hmm. It didn't work
and
out
she
for
was
you.
The one with the income, but you know how it is. You know, the judge mm-hmm. thinks that the woman is the responsible parent and gave her the house.
Mm-hmm. And the musician couldn't be.
Yeah. Well, as it turned out, you know, when she was going to law school, I mean, the kids were getting dropped off at my house at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Anyway.
And she was staying to study until 11 o'clock at night. So they were getting dropped off asleep on the couch mm-hmm. and picked up asleep off the mm-hmm. couch. And, you know, so they slept in that house, but they didn't have many waking hours there. And in the summertime, I would get the key. And I would take them up. The beach was for residents, you know, mm-hmm. so I would take them up to the beach up there. I would take them to their...
You were very involved.
Dance lessons. Yeah, I was very much involved. But we don't need to go into all of that. Yeah. That's not Duval stuff, really.
So what were your impressions of Duval when you...
Well, it was a little mm-hmm. town. When mm-hmm. I first started coming here in 74, mm-hmm. it was... Half the houses were actually empty, I'm told, and it was only about 250 people living here, is what I'm told. Although when I went to find a place to live, the guys in the band found me one outside of town, which is more convenient for them in terms of rehearsals and whatnot. So I don't know town too well, but it was just loggers and farmers, mostly at that point in time. I guess you'd probably be beginning to have a few people that commuted to the Boeing Everett plant, mm. even the Boeing Renton plant.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, after I got divorced, they built this neighborhood where I live now, and my ex wanted me to go back into carpentry, because I also, at the time we had to move from Index, we were caretaking that place, so there wasn't any rent.
Mm.
Still getting it?
Should be. In the right time.
Okay. We needed to pay rent when we moved here to Duval, and so I got a job at the sawmill the one in Sultan there. There's an alder mill. And I worked there for a while, and then Quentin, my washtub bass player in my band, took a job as a carpenter on a project building condos down just off of 520. On the north side of 520, west of where there used to be a drive-in theater there.
Mm-hmm.
And he got me a job on that. So I quit the sawmill and I became a carpenter's apprentice, basically, on that. And I worked various different carpentry jobs, but they were kind of seasonal. You know, once you get done with a project, you're laid off you know, you're either waiting for the company to find, you know, get another job going
you
and see if they need
skills,
you.
Skills, though, you could do. Some
yeah, well, I learned some carpentry, and Quentin and I got in a wreck one night, New Year's Eve. That would have been probably 1975, New Year's Eve. We're on our way home from work, and. Quentin had a few snorts with the boys at the job before, mm-hmm. and I was a little nervous.
Mm-hmm.
And then he stopped at the liquor store here in town to buy some more to go home and party with his wife up on Maple Road. And we were going up around the bend right where there's a barn that burned down, and there's still part of it there. It was a big barn, and now there's just a little sort of shed-type building on an S-curve up there. We're going around that S-curve, and I knew that the fog was going to be freezing to the road.
Mm.
And I'm holding on tight to my armrest, and Quentin looks over, and he could see the white knuckles, and he said, what are you worrying about, you know? And then we started fishtailing up around, you're going up, so you're losing some of your traction because of the weight when you go up over this hill and then around a bend, and it's black ice right there. Mm-hmm. Started fishtailing, and finally the left front wheel went off the road and just buried to the axle in the loose gravel on that side of the road, and the car went end for end and down about a 15-foot bank and landed on its top.
Over and over?
Well, just end for end and okay. upside down, slid backwards.
Oh, no.
I don't know how many, you know.
Wow. 20, very serious.
30, 40 yards. We slid upside down, and the top to the his international travel all was crushed straight down to the body.
Oh, my God.
And
did you survive?
Well, and then, you know, the windows are all, you know, the top is crushed to the body. We can't get out. But it turns out Quentin tried to open the door when the car is going end for end and jump out.
He tried to.
Oh. He got the door ajar. Okay. So the door was not latched. Otherwise, the door probably would not have opened.
Yeah.
So he kicked the door out, and we crawled out through there. And while Quentin is standing there crying over the loss of his 64 Travelall, International Travelall, which he called the corn binder, because they're more famous for building farm equipment.
International Harvester?
Yeah, International Harvester.
Yeah, I had one once.
Anyway, I was severely bruised from the armrest hitting me right on the ham there, you know, and I've hobbled up the hill to try to get help. And the first guy to come along was Dan Kirsten, our other bandmate. And one look at me, and then I could see that he was severely rattled. And I said, Quentin's down there crying over his truck, you know, and I don't know if he's hurt or anything. But I went to the nearest house, wherever it was, you know, a quarter mile away maybe, and called 911. And Dan went down to try to help Quentin, and he was going to give us rides home, I guess. Quentin went away in an ambulance. Turned out he had broken his collarbone.
Okay.
And they told him that. They said, how do you figure you broke your collarbone? And Quentin said, I probably must have stepped on it when I was crawling out of the truck.
Wow. That was a good response.
The statute of limitations has expired, so he's not going to get a ticket for driving a little bit drunk, and he didn't get one for that. Dan gave
shocking.
Me a ride home.
Shocking.
Yeah, yeah. I felt for a while like he tried to kill me when he tried to climb out of the car.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got over that. And but, yeah, it was an adventure. And I continued doing carpentry, and I was writing for the Mother Earth News. And
playing
gigs.
With Okie Doke.
With the Okie Doke String Band.
String Band.
And at a certain point, though, one night, Dan called me, I guess. Probably had a phone by then. Dan told me that there was going to be a band meeting at his cabinet shop down here in town.
Mm-hmm.
And that was unusual. I knew that something was up. We never rehearsed there. We never had meetings there. If they were having a meeting there, I knew something was up. So I got to this band. We had added a fifth person who was a member of the Love family, a guy whose name was Jubal Kantanda. His real name was Eric something. I've met him, run into him since, but he was a member of the Love family. He played clarinet, I think, with us. And he may have been added just to be a voting block to vote me out. What happened is at the meeting they said, well, we don't want to play with you anymore.
Oh, no. What a bizarre experience.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, so what I said was, okay, well, I'm keeping the name since I brought the name, even though you guys picked a name out of several choices that I offered. I'm keeping the name. I said, we don't care about the name. And I said, we also have 2 or 3 months' worth of gigs lined up in front of us here, and I'm the one that hustled those gigs.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't want to play with me anymore, I'll get some other guys, and we'll go out and we'll be okey-doke.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys can be whoever you want. And they said, oh, well, you know, there's money involved. All right, we'll play out the gigs that we have lined in front of us, and then, you know, after 2 months, we won't play with you anymore.
What? Why were they being so weird?
Well, it was coming from Larry, I think. You know, you guys are pretty mediocre, but I think I could make something out of it.
So he still retain that?
Well, I don't know. You know, I mean, it's something I've thought about for decades since, and I could explain how I understand it to you, I suppose. But anyway, here's what happened. So after 2 weeks, Dan and Quentin came to me. Larry was not going to play out the gigs because he was the instigator of this, and he didn't want to play with me anymore. Okay. That was that. He was quitting the band. And he went, he was a bit of a bar fly, and not just in one bar, but you know, every bar in three counties, you know. Mm. He went into all of them and told them the band was broke up. Mm. We lost one gig, but it was my fault partly, because we were supposed to open for, I think, Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen, or Asleep at the Wheel, one of those groups. And I told the promoter that Larry had quit, and he goes, "Oh well, we'll save you for the next one." You know, so we lost that gig. Mm. But Dan and Quentin came to me 2 weeks later, and they said, "Would you take us back? We don't think that we can really be partners with Larry."
Okay.
And
so it was really just Larry that you lost, then.
Well, so yeah, Larry. Quit, since he had instigated trying to throw me out of the band that I started.
Wow.
And
it was a remade band then.
Well, we went on as a trio that we'd been before he joined, you know.
Okay.
In fact, I said that to the guy, the guy from the company that was promoting the show that we didn't get to do. I said, "Well, we're just going to go on like we were before Larry joined." But Larry was, you know, as far as that guy was concerned, he was the centerpiece of the band, and as far as Larry was concerned, it was probably the case also. But we went on without Larry, and we did some. We had opened with Larry. We had opened for Dan Hicks and his Acoustic Warriors at the Fabulous Rainbow for two shows one night, and we'd opened for David Bromberg Band. That might have been two shows also. I think it was. On the same night, and then we also opened for the Turtles. Well, they weren't called the Turtles at the time. It was just the Fluorescent Leech and Eddie, Flo and Eddie. Their manager owned the name. The previous manager had owned the name the Turtles, and it took them quite a long time. I think they finally got the name back, and they now are able to tour as the Turtles again. But yeah, we'd had some big gigs, and the same promoter on all those, and then when Larry quit the band, as far as that guy was concerned, Larry was our chief selling point, I guess. We went on without him, and we you know, Dan stayed with the band until 1981, after we made our first record. Larry was on the record in the recording session. He's on one of the songs on the EP that we did, but it was recorded before he actually was an official member of the band.
What was Dan's last name?
Kirsten.
Okay.
Dan had traded a Fender steel guitar with legs, you know, not a lap. It's kind of like a lap steel, but one with legs. And he traded it for the recording time and recorded Milk Call Blues, and Larry's on mandolin on that track. This was before he joined the band. I joined it probably shortly after that, and then by the time he quit, we started working on a record, and Dan had been given a 8-hour recording session by Doug Schauer, who had been in a band from Duval called CW Thrills, and was a friend.
So what was Quentin's last name?
Roten, R-H-O-T-O-N.
And then did this band keep going on for a long time?
Well, yeah, as I was saying, Dan, after we put our first record out, which they arrived on the truck, I paid for a recording session to do two songs after we had done a little tour to California, and I brought a tape recorder along, and we recorded two of the shows live, and I decided I didn't think my stuff was as good as Dan's studio stuff, so I rented time in a studio in Bothell, called Thunder Oak Audio, and cut a couple songs, and we put out an EP. This is all 1980 when I'm doing the recording and arranging for the pressing, but the pressings didn't arrive until January 2nd, 1981, so technically speaking, the record was released in 1981. And a few months later, Dan quit the band. He was going to join another band he thought was going to be working a lot more. He and Quentin had both moved to Mercer Island, and there was another musician renting the house with them, and Dan joined a band with him called Cowboy Clyde and the Wichita Kid. They were going to work six nights a week, they thought. That didn't really work out, but Quentin stayed with me, and there was a succession of different people filling for Dan. Since he played three instruments, I mostly had to have, you know, two other guys to replace him. to keep up the sound. And it was, you know, a bunch of different guys, including at one point Billy Helts, who was the washboard player who inspired me to take up the washboard in the first place. And one of his old bandmates from the Fly Bennett Jazz Band, Johnny Ward. They were both from Portland, but both of them lived up here for a short time.
So what kind of changes in Duval did you see during those times?
Well, of course, first they built this neighborhood, and while I was a carpenter and living here in town, I had gotten another job for the same company that had built the Yarrowwood condominiums, which was my first job. Some of the guys, I think it was a new company, but they started another company, and they got in touch with me, and they wanted me to work on a couple of houses on Virginia Street here that were already done, already had people living in them, but there'd been a law passed in this state, a lemon law for houses. People had a year, and if they could find something wrong with the house, they could complain, and then the contractor would have to come back and fix. And there was some things that needed to be fixed up there on Virginia Street, and they knew I lived here, so they hired me back. And then I, their next project was five houses in a development called Misty Meadows in the area of what is now Mill Creek, but Mill Creek didn't exist.
So you saw a lot of houses.
Yeah, so, and like I say, my ex wanted me to go to work in back into the trades. By the time that happened, I mean, my last job as a carpenter before we got divorced was I had put an ad in the Valley View or the Woodinville, it was probably the Woodinville Weekly, that said, you know, home repairs made easy, I do them. Mm-hmm. And so I was doing any kind of little jobs, you know, whether it was remodeling a bathroom or building a little deck or just fixing stuff for people.
Mm-hmm.
I did that for a couple of years, and somewhere along in there, a guy from Carnation called me up one day, and he says, I see your ad in the paper. I've got an ad in the same paper advertising the same kind of work. He says, do you have enough work?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I'm getting by, but I wouldn't mind having more. And he says, well, I'll tell you what, I've got more work than I can handle. Why don't you go to work for me for 15 bucks an hour, and I will work with you when it needs to be two of us, and I'll just deal with the customers and lining out new jobs, you know, the rest of the time. And I'll keep you busy all the time. Mm-hmm. I'll keep me busy. So I went to work for him, and I stopped running my ad. And then he went through a divorce, and I was out of work again, and I'm looking for work as a carpenter in the newspaper, and I remember seeing an ad that said they wanted a journeyman carpenter, which I considered myself to be. They wanted 8 years' experience. I had five. Your own truck, your own tools, had all that. They wanted to pay $5 an hour. And I showed the ad to my wife, and I said, you know, even if I took this job, we're not going to be able to get by on it, so you're going to have to go out and get a job.
Mm-hmm.
I said, why don't you go out and get a job? I'm already working two other jobs, playing music on the weekends and writing for the magazine. I'll stay home and take care of the kids. And that is part of why she divorced me, because Daddy's supposed to be the provider, and she didn't realize it about the time Reagan got elected. The paradigm had shifted, and now Mommy and Daddy are both going to have to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think a year or two after the divorce, she began to realize that. But
the
trust was broken. I was not going back by then. But yeah, Duval started to get built up, and it's as you know, it's what is it, 7,000 or 8,000 people that live here now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was 250 when I moved here, or so I've heard. And
did you see
it's got to the place where you know, you go to Duval days and you don't see anybody you remember from the 70s, even though they might be there, some of them.
Did you miss the old times?
Yeah, I mean, it's still a great town, though. You know, I'm glad I live here. I noticed that the group of artsy-fartsy hippies that lived here when I arrived, many of them left because it wasn't the hip place anymore.
Okay.
Some went to Port Townsend. Some went east of the mountains because, you know, it was the city was encroaching too much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were going to, you know, farther out there. I'm one of the ones who stayed. I like it here. And there were a few people like Mike Ball and Denny Redman, Douglas Johnston, various people, you know, stayed because we just like it here. I still like it here. It's getting built up. They built a development took away my view of the valley, but we knew that when we bought this house.
Mm. Which way?
That way.
Okay.
You live in it.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But there was a 5-acre horse pasture there with a couple of horses in it when we moved here. And we knew that the Mrs. Trim, who owned the little farmhouse that the young folks have been fixing up really
who
nice.
Who owned that?
A lady named Mrs. Trim. There was a lot of them. There's some still here in the valley.
A few
days ago, I ran into a guy standing there looking at the house, and she told me he'd grown up in the house.
Oh.
And he had cousins around here. And one of her sons, I think, or a nephew, whatever, she was going to sell this property, mm-hmm. and it was going to get developed. We knew that when we bought this house. We thought we had 5 years. It ended up taking 7. And I, at the time, you know, I was thinking, God, I can't wish that the economy would tank. But if I could, mm-hmm. I'd wish the economy would tank and stop this development from mm-hmm. happening. Instead, what happened is the development got probably 95% done, and then the economy tanked.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know about you folks, because you're new in there. You weren't the original owners, were you?
Mm-mm.
But most of those people were underwater for a few years.
Okay, 15-year-old.
And there was a few of them that probably got foreclosed on.
Mm-hmm. So this was which tanking was this?
2008,
okay.
It finally tanked.
Yeah.
But I mean,
the
development was almost done. There were only 3 or 4 lots that weren't built, and one of them was the one that blocks the maximum amount of our view here, which originally that was a wetland. They were going to leave that, and that was going to be a park. But the people in the cul-de-sac next one, Anderson Road, they banded together and they raised a big stink about all those trees that were there, and they didn't want to lose that forest that they had. We had a valley view, they had a forest, and they wanted
mm-hmm.
to keep the forest.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a compromise made. They gave the developer this lot to build the house, and the developer said he was only going to he was going to leave 10% of the trees.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, after they cut down the rest of them, the next big wind came along and knocked down, you know, more than half of the ones that were left.
Can you talk about your magazine and how long you've been doing that?
Well, after I went through the divorce and I'm trying to make a living, a year or so, 1983, the divorce started in the end of 81, and it probably took until March of 83 to be
mm-hmm.
final, but as far as I was concerned, it was final the day she moved out
mm-hmm.
into the new house and didn't take me with her. Mother Earth News decided at a certain point to not to cancel my column. I think they gave it to somebody else. They fired me. They relieved me of my duties. Part of the reason they did that, I think, is I decided to put a book together out of the columns,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't want the people at Mother Earth News to edit it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they believed in hoking up the copy, you know, real. They mm-hmm. wanted it folksy,
mm-hmm.
so they were making me sound kind of stupid. One example is I did an article. I happened to get to know 2 or 3 of the actually 3 or 4 of the top Autohar players in the world.
Uh-huh.
Each of these people had won the contests, or one of them they might have been beyond the contest by the time they had Brian Bowers.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of king of the auto harp, is a friend of mine, and Jewel Basil, who won the contest 1 year, and a guy named Lindsey Hazley. I don't know if he ever won it, but he was also a great auto harp player. These people taught me how to hot rod auto harps. You can take the bars that deaden strings, so you can make chords. You can put new ones in, you know. And I did an article on that, and because the magazine's policy was you can't use a word twice in the article, and there are no synonyms for the term auto harp.
Yeah.
And you're writing about auto harps, you're going to have to use the word over
mm-hmm.
and over. So they made up these synonyms. Tune maker was one of them.
Mm.
And it just,
it's ridiculous.
It made me sound ridiculous. It made
mm-hmm.
me sound silly and stupid. So I didn't want them to edit my book. So I did all the work. It turned out, you know, compiling a bunch of columns into a book sounds easy. It was more work to turn them into a book than it had been to write them in the first place, to edit out some of this stupid stuff. And then I found a publisher in Seattle, and they had their own editor, who I think did make significant improvements on what I had done. And it came out as a book, but I think the people at Mother Earth News were mad, and they wouldn't sell it. since they weren't the publisher.
You never got it sold?
And they didn't even want me to be able to advertise it in my column, so they fired me and got another person. Column ran on for maybe another year. And now Mother Earth News, which was published in North Carolina originally, is published in New York City. It's like those Pace Picante sauce ads,
it's,
you know, New York City, get a rope.
Yeah. It's basically went into Mother Earth News, or?
Yeah, Mother Earth News was where my column was, but.
Mother of Nurse.
No, Mother Earth
Earth's
News.
Earth's News. Okay, yeah. Well, I'm very familiar with Mother Earth News.
Yeah, I wrote for them for 6 years, and yeah. I met someone somewhere recently who still subscribed. I think there's a person that doesn't live here that was visiting someone down on the beach this summer who gets the magazine and said, oh, no, it's still a real good magazine. So they're still out there. But I was cast adrift as a professional writer there for a while, and I tried to write an article about street musicians for Rolling Stone, which it was a good idea. I didn't really have the article. I mean, I'd have had to travel to some other cities. You know, it wasn't like they were going to give me an assignment and an expense account.
Yeah.
They liked the idea. They didn't buy the article. Mm-hmm. And I tried to write something for Playboy magazine, mainly because they were one of the best paying markets.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what it was I wanted to write for them. It was probably not the same idea. But finally, I decided to start my own magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happened is I'm a songwriter. And, and after Larry described my music as rockabilly, I began to identify myself not only as a rockabilly musician, but as a rockabilly musician. And there was a band in Seattle called the Moondogs that I thought was the most authentic sort of vintage-style rockabilly band around. Several sort of oldies bands that did that, but they were doing it with an upright bass and real authentic. So I went to visit their singer who played the bass.
Just looking at the battery. Should be okay.
And I went down to visit him. I wanted to pitch songs at him. Because I thought, you know, the one thing they needed was some original songs, and I had some. Maybe they could record my songs. But he got on his high horse that day. This guy had a 56 Ford with Ray Vaughan on the plate, you know, from Buddy Holly. Didn't write that song, but a song that Buddy Holly recorded. He started pacing back and forth in his living room and complaining about The Rocket, which was Seattle's rock newspaper. And he says, they don't cover the kind of music that we play or the stuff that we like in that magazine anywhere near enough. I mean, if Robert Cray, who was from around here originally, if he gets internationally famous, well, then The Rocket's forced to put them on their cover. But they didn't care about him all that much up to then. And the reason was that the people at The Rocket believed what I also believed, which was that Seattle was going to be the next Liverpool or the next San Francisco. Mm. I had been saying stuff like that since the late 70s myself.
Well, it became
and so they were pushing
grunge,
whatever they
right?
thought was the next big thing,
yeah.
and they didn't think it was going to be blues or rockabilly or anything like that, you know, country. They
and
thought
then
it was going to be
for grunge.
Well, they were right, and it did happen, you know, and I was right too. I mean, I was one of the people who said those things. Anyway, he says there ought to be a magazine or there ought to be a paper or something, you know, that covers our kind of music. And I mean, he got pretty worked up about it. And I thought to myself, you know, I'm a person who has been a professional writer, so I have some skills in that area. Mm-hmm. I've also done layout in the yearbook and pasted up layouts for posters and stuff like that. So I have some graphic skills, not great ones necessarily, but. And I have a reputation as a band leader in this area for quite a few years, so I know a lot of the club owners and a lot of the other musicians. I thought, I'm probably the person that ought to do this, you know. He's right. It ought to be done. It needs to be done. I also knew that there wasn't much chance you could make any money doing it. But I knew that it ought to be done, and I thought to myself, you know, for once in your life, when you have an idea that needs to be done, you ought to just go ahead and do it. And I fussed around for a while trying to figure out a name, and I came up with this name, Blue Suede News. I don't even know what any of the other choices were, but that's the one I chose. I did not realize at the time that the name had been used for a column in a British magazine called Melody Maker. I knew of the magazine, but it's even remotely possible that I would have seen the column somewhere along the line. I don't think so. I didn't have enough money to buy Melody Maker, and you know, but
so you've been doing this.
I didn't find that out till many years later, or a couple, 3 years
later. How long have you been doing this then?
So that was in January of 1986, or maybe late 85, or 85, I started having the idea, and then Rick Nelson got killed in a plane accident, and I put him on the cover of the first one that I did, and I went to some of the local record stores and some of the local nightclubs that played the Rootsy, you know, where the bands, you know, were playing that.
Yeah.
And I got enough advertising, and I went to the printer I thought I'd arranged. I went to them first, and I told them how many pages I wanted, and they gave me a price. And so I sold my advertising based on that number, and then when I went to get it printed, they said, oh, no, it's going to cost you twice as much. Well, I did not have the money in my pocket. I'm making a living as a musician and a writer, and I'm not making any money as a writer anymore. And I had two kids, although most of the financial support for them was coming from their mother. I was, most of the time was coming from me, which was taking away from time to hustle for gigs or anything else, you know. And I was feeding them. Because they were at my house most of the time, not on weekends. I was supposed to have them every other weekend, but because I'm making my living on the weekends, and she was leaving them there, she wasn't picking them up at 6 o'clock, you know, we kind of traded those times, and I didn't have them on the weekend very often because I had gigs. But anyway, I said, well, give me a minute, you know, I don't have this extra $300 or whatever it was going to be, and I shopped around. I found another printer. I went to Snohomish Publishing, and I got the print job for what I had sold in advertising. So I didn't have any money in it. I only had my time in it, and basically it began as what you might call an advertising cooperative, in that I was getting my ads, which I thought were going to generate some business for me, you know, ads for my act, ads for any recordings I might have had available, my book and stuff. And the other advertisers were paying for their ads, and that was paying for the print job. And, and it was a free publication that was that I would drive in, and I would leave them in all the nightclubs that had the blues and roots music, and at the record stores and the music stores that would allow me to do it. I thought when I started it that, you know, the Golden Oldies, which had become a chain of stores, I thought this is perfect, to be a perfect place. And then Dean Silverstone, the owner, would not allow me to put a pile of magazines to give away, I guess partly because it was an ad for Bob Street Records in there, and he didn't want his customers to know they could go anywhere else to buy records or whatever. He didn't want to give me any counter space. I did it for a couple of years on that basis and discovered that not only was I not making any money, I wasn't selling more advertising. Although I was selling subscriptions, when it's free, people don't buy subscriptions. And I would go down to the Owl Cafe, for instance, in it's now Connor Byrne down in Ballard, and I would watch people take their magazine in, down into the dark where their table was, and use it as a coaster for their beer pitcher of beer, and then leave it, you know, with a ring of beer sweat, you know, or whatever, spilled beer, you know. And I got tired of that. And I didn't want to be one of the free publications around here anymore. And I gave up for a year. I spent that year, I wrote a screenplay instead. And attempted to sell the screenplay. It was about a blues man from Mississippi meeting some street musicians in Pike Place Market. And I actually got an agent. Oddly enough, and my agent was living in the what I like to call the veritable center of the cinema cyclone in Kent, Washington. And she was, you know, I think a divorced housewife working out of her garage. She did finally get me an offer for my screenplay. She had told me when I went down to Kent to sign a contract with her, I said, how much money do you think we can get for a screenplay? And she said, $50,000. I said, you know, I could certainly live with that.
I could use that,
And so then she finally brought me an offer after a few months, And the offer was for $2,500. And I said, "What?" I said, "You mean this is an offer? What do you call it? An option? They want to option my screenplay for 6 months. That's the kind of money you might be expecting for an option, where the person says, "Well, I'll option it for 6 months and try to pull together a deal.
Mm-hmm.
If I pull together a deal, you get the $25,000, the $50,000, whatever." No, she said it's a buyout offer. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, I'm not very impressed."
Yeah.
And they came back with an offer of $4,000, which I probably should have took. One day I was down in California working on my car, I think, or in my dad's garage, in my parents' garage down there, and the phone rang, and we didn't get to the phone in time. I think it may have been the guy. I had had a call into this guy who wanted to buy it, and I just wanted to talk to the buyer. And it might have been him. We never got through to him. But interestingly enough, the guy who was supposed to buy my screenplay, his name was Joe Camacho, and he lived in Culver City, California. Now, right at this point in time, there was a big brouhaha going on because a guy named O.J. Simpson's ex-wife had been murdered, and he'd been caught, the Bronco, going south on the freeway. Everybody knows the story, but there was one piece of the story that came out was he had purchased a knife from a guy named Jose Camacho in Culver City, California. And they wondered if the knife that he'd purchased could have been the murder weapon. I don't think that was ever determined, but it's just an odd detail that the guy who wanted to buy my screenplay was named Joe Camacho, and he was also from Culver City, California. I mean, my fantasy is that Joe probably just stole my script and made a porn film in the Philippines based on
probably.
My script. Who knows? That may not have happened. The whole deal. I probably should have taken the $4,000. I could have at least bought myself a better car. I didn't, I was holding out for the $50,000.
And, of course.
As a result, nothing ever happened. My fantasy about it now is it'd be fun to turn it into a graphic novel, which might yet end up with a movie, I'm not the artist to do it, and I haven't found one who could. But meanwhile, after a year of hiatus while I wrote the screenplay and tried to sell it, my cousin, who was in the film business as an animator, had been working for Ross Bagdasarian on the first Chipmunks movie, based on the song that came out when we were kids. I own a copy of the record. And I also have it on CD, and the sequel made with they made a sequel with Canned Heat, oddly enough. and that same guy, Ross Bagdasarian, his earlier hit was The Witch Doctor.
Oh, yes.
Ding, bang. Yeah, he made that record, and then he had the Chipmunk song. And then the first thing that they did, this is before they had a TV series, they made the movie, the first Chipmunk movie, and my cousin Andrew was working on it as a layout artist, which means he designs the scene and the character, and then he may draw another picture of the character in different places, and then they send it to the Philippines or somewhere where Korea, where they work cheap, and they draw all the pictures in between, because it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pictures to make a film. But he was afraid, when the film was done, that he was going to be out of a job, and he wanted to basically buy into my magazine. He gave me $1,000 and to start the magazine back up, and maybe there would be a job for him there. I spent $700 of those dollars on an ad in Rolling Stone, and all you get is a little classified ad about Blue Suede News. I'd been running ads this year for the back issues in two magazines. One is called Goldmine, it's a record collector magazine, and the other was called Discoveries, published out of Port Townsend, actually. And my ads in Goldmine were producing people who only wanted to buy a particular issue with the guy on the front that they collect. My ads in Discoveries were producing people who buy all 11 issues that I'd published. They wanted all of them. So it was more effective. But I put this ad in Rolling Stone. I got, I think, three responses to the $700 ad. two of them were people telling me that the ad was worded badly. And one person bought a magazine, or all 11, I forget. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't very much. We didn't get much response. The other $300, I think, helped paid my rent for the month it took me to put together another issue of the magazine. And
you made it
and Andrew, of course, before the film was over, he was hired by somebody else, and it's gone like that ever since. Not so much now. He's an independent contractor down there, but I mean, for another decade or more, he wasn't ever really out of work. He was being hired away before he was done with one.
Well, how about so you became a subscription magazine?
Yes, I decided I would put a price on the cover, and I did get a national distributor, the Tower Records and Books chain.
Mm-hmm.
The guy there, I came up with a new tagline, the magazine. I decided I needed a tagline, and my tagline was House Organ of the Church of Rock and Roll. And Doug, the guy that was the magazine buyer for Tower, said, well, there isn't much to it, but I think that tagline has a lot of promise. So I got national distribution. And because I had national distribution with him, I picked up some more national distribution with three or four or five other mm-hmm. other distributors. Some of them were more regional. I had one in L.A., and I had one in a couple of them in the New York area, mm-hmm. and one in
it's
Seattle.
Doing great.
And I had another national distributor in Seattle, too, and I had one in Austin. And, so Tower was a very good distributor for the magazine. Mm-hmm. The deal I got from them, which was not repeated by anybody else, it wasn't in writing, but they never paid me for any less than 60% of the shipments, and if they paid me for 60%, they would return the other 40%, the complete magazine, so I would still have them for back issue sales.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else, I had to accept what was called affidavit returns, which means that the store that gets the magazines tears off the masthead, puts them in an envelope, mails them back to the distributor. The distributor counts them, and I have to accept their affidavit that that's how many there were.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Personally, I think it's entirely possible that's a corrupt system. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Tower is what kept me going. And, I mean, I even had, later on, I had one of my writers, one of my contributors, who travels the world a lot, came back and he said, oh, I found Blue Suede News in the Tower Records in Singapore. So we were in Singapore, we were in Tokyo, we were in Paris, we were in London, Brussels,
you
maybe.
You did very well.
We
you
were
did
in
amazing.
Ireland. Yeah, I had international distribution.
And it's still going.
And I was actually getting paid. At its peak, I figure I probably was maybe starting to begin to make minimum wage for the amount of time I put in.
Mm-hmm.
We got all the way up to 68 pages. We were only 16 pages when I first got national distribution. About a year later, after that, I went to 32, and another maybe a year or less later, I put a slick cover around the 32, so it went to 36 pages, and then it went from 36 to 40-some, and all the way up to 68. I was 68 pages from issue 32. To issue 56, maybe. It might have been eight less than that in one of those, but.
So you started doing some international. Is this how you met Gabby? I'd like to hear about.
Yes,
that.
Actually, what happened is I was trading magazines with several rockabilly publications
mm-hmm.
from Europe, and one day in January of 1996, I got a letter from Gabby. She was the publisher of a magazine called Rockin' 50s.
Uh-huh.
Published out of Munich, Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And in her letter, she said she wondered if I would be interested in trading magazines with
mm-hmm.
her. And then she said, my magazine is mostly in German. There's a little bit in English, but a lot of pictures, and you can at least
mm-hmm.
Find out what's going on over here. And it was my policy at that point in time to trade subscriptions with everybody in the same business,
mm-hmm.
just partly as a publisher courtesy, but also because, as Cy Sperling used to say in his ads, I'm also a client, meaning I'm also a songwriter and a singer and a recording
mm-hmm.
artist, and I wanted to curry favor with those
mm-hmm.
people and maybe get my own recordings reviewed. So I didn't just send Gabby a magazine, I sent her a CD that another guy I knew had put out a compilation called All American Hardcore Hillbillies.
Uh-huh.
And he had four of my songs were on that compilation. It was, I think, the second. There was an earlier compilation that I had, a cassette compilation. I had a couple of songs on too, but All American Hardcore Hillbillies had four studio recordings. The other one, I think, I'd done them in the drummer's basement. They weren't quite as good, but I sent her that, and I got another letter back from Gabby saying, thanks for the magazine. She really liked it, and well, it had her magazine in it. With a letter, and she said she also thanked me for the CD and said she really liked my music. In fact, she liked it so much, she thought maybe she'd like to do a story about me in Rockin' 50s if I could send her some more pictures and send her enough information to build an article out of. So I wrote an article. I had a couple of pseudonyms because people started giving me a hard time because my name appeared too often in the magazine because I was writing most of it. And people thought that's a lot of self-promotion. You got ads, and your name is appearing all over the place. So I made up two pseudonyms. One was M. Bistro, because the University Bistro was one of my regular advertisers. And they had a songwriter showcase that I attended religiously. And they had blues in there, you know. It's where Jazz Alley originated. And Jazz Alley moved uptown, and it became University Bistro. So I was M. Bistro, and Johnny Ward, who I mentioned earlier, who was a sax and harmonica and guitar player that played with me briefly and had been in a band called the Fly Benet Jazz Band out of Portland, jazz with two S's, and he and Billy Heltz. Johnny had, when he played briefly in my band, he gave me the moniker Mick Barstool, which is, I don't know what you call that, it's a perversion of my real name, and I kind of was tickled by it. So I used that as a pseudonym, and I wrote a story about myself. And I gave Mick Barstool the byline, and I sent it to Gabby, and she translated it into German and gave Mick Barstool the byline, but she had some suspicions that I had written it myself.
And, that was very funny.
Yeah. But in her second letter that enclosed with a copy of her magazine, she also said, by the way, I'm coming to the United States next July for a rockabilly festival in Denver to cover it for my magazine. And, you know, you ought to cover this festival for your magazine, too. If you come there, then I can get maybe some pictures of my own and do an interview, or I can, you know, learn some more about you and for this article I want to do. And I didn't feel like I could afford to do that, but I decided to do it anyway. There was a guy I knew who had a rockabilly radio program on KSER, and he and his teenage son and I, we split the price of a room in the hotel, and we split the price of a car rental, and we flew up there, and that made it a little more doable for me. And I met
Gabby. Where was it?
In Denver, at the Regency Hotel. It's not the Hyatt Regency. It was a kind of a rundown old hotel, and the air conditioning tunnel was right next to my room, and just every 15 minutes it would roar like a jet engine.
Yes.
But it was a cool little festival. Mm-hmm. I didn't just get to meet her. I got to meet a bunch of people from all over the world. Mm. And some famous, you know, rock and rollers from America.
Really,
and
some
people that were really, you know, movers and shakers in the European rockabilly scene. Mm-hmm. And it was cool. I met Gabby. That second letter that she sent me, there was a masthead for the magazine. It was letterhead. Mm-hmm. And up at the top, there were two names. There was her name. And there was a name, Ramon Friedrichs, and then there was an address. Well, in the second letter, she had written the word Miss next to Gabby Mogg. And I looked at that, and I thought, well, clearly she wants me to know she's female, but it also appears she wants me to know she's single. Now, Gabby has denied up one side and down the other that there was any such intention.
Yeah.
She just wanted me to know she was female because the name Gabby, at that point in time, there was a guy that was running the best rockabilly mail order company in the world, in America, and his name was Gabby Castellana. And there was Gabby Hayes. She thought that, you know, the name Gabby in America probably looked like a man's name, and she didn't want, you know, she wanted to be credit for, you know, as the editor of this magazine and publisher, she wanted it known she was female. But I've told this story to many, many Americans, and every one of them would have seen it the same way I did.
Yes.
Maybe she wants me to know she's single.
Yeah.
She wasn't. As it turns out, Ramon Friedrichs was the guy she lived with. I met them both. And I staked out a table just inside the double doors to this ballroom where the festival was held, and laid out my magazines and my, I don't know if I had any CDs yet then, I didn't, but cassettes and albums and singles and whatnot. Well, it was a little EP. And I hadn't paid for a booth, you know, I just was doing that. And so she and Ramon sat at the table with me, and there was another couple that sat there, both of whom were radio presenters in the South San Francisco Bay Area, down around, well, north of San Jose. I think they're both on the same station down there. And we all sat there and socialized together and got along real well. And I could not figure out that whole weekend if Gabby was and Ramon were a couple or not.
Yeah.
One reason I couldn't tell is because about 10 o'clock every evening he would leave and go back up to the hotel room. He'd say, I want to pull through the records we've bought on our trip here, or whatever he said. I mean, he didn't speak much English. And to my way of thinking, it doesn't make much sense to leave a beautiful young woman in a room
alone,
full of horny young rockabilly guys,
right,
dressed to the nines, tens, elevens,
and
covered
like,
with tattoos.
Yeah, and you're like the
hair
look
slicked
her,
back
I think,
and ready
right,
to roll,
yeah,
you know. I didn't think that made much sense, so it didn't make them seem like much of a couple. And I did see them together at the car show on Saturday morning or Sunday morning, whenever the car show was, and they weren't holding hands, but that was the only time it looked a little bit to me like they might be a couple. But I didn't do anything but observe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Gabby tells me that she was thinking, what's this old guy doing checking me out, you know, looking me up and down. Well, I was doing that because I wondered if she was, you know.
You were.
I didn't know. But, you know, so it was another year later, and she did a story on me with Mick Barstool as the byline, and we traded magazines some more, and she bought some of my recordings at that festival, I think, my album and maybe my little EP, and she had that stuff to add to her article or whatever. And she reviewed some Filet Gumbo. I think I gave her, you know, a Filet Gumbo CD to review in there, too. And so the following year, the same festival happened again, and we all met up at the same festival. And
you were for sure going to go. That's for
yeah, well, I went. By this time, well, Blue Suede News, in the beginning, was a liability. I forgot to mention this, but when I quit doing it after the first couple of years, my income had dropped by $1,000 the first year, and by the second year was down another $1,000, so $2,000 less.
Yeah.
And I was living marginally. I mean, the primary skill that you need to make a living as a musician is lowered expectations and learning how to live on the cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And I did realize after a few years of doing it that because I'm allowed to write my travel to gigs off at it was only 15 cents a mile. Way back, it's a lot more than that. Now it's like 55 or 57, whatever it is. But I realized that it's not costing me as much as it does other people to drive their cars, because what I'm driving is an old beater that some insurance company has written off, and the person drove until they got a new car and then sold it to me for $200.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a dented fender.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a total loss as far as the insurance company is concerned, but it's still perfectly, you know, drivable transportation, you know. All I have to do is not care that I have a dent on my fender.
Mm-hmm.
And I was maintaining them myself, too, you know, doing the mechanic work.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized I'm making half of my living. I'm writing off half my income as travel, but it's not costing me all that much. So a big chunk of that, I'm making half my living as a car mechanic. And the magazine, after I started having national circulation and I was getting money for subscriptions and for store circulation, it eventually tripled my income, which wasn't a lot. It's not saying a lot. It sounds like a lot. But, I mean, I was making twice as much on the magazine as I was making playing music. And with the music, I noticed that no matter how hard I hustled, I couldn't increase my income by more than about 10%.
Mm-hmm.
And if I slacked off completely from hustling and was concentrating on doing the magazine, my income didn't drop by more than 10%.
Mm-hmm.
But $1,000 was 10%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went back to hustling gigs and writing that screenplay and trying to make some money so I could buy a house. and then Andrew got me back into doing the magazine, and we got national circulation. It built up to the point where, you know, my income was tripled because I was making twice as much on the magazine, as, and I was still making the other third, you know, playing music. About the time that I met Gabby, and the second year there, you know, we met up. It was the same scene of the same five of us mm-hmm. sitting around this one table right near the entrance where I was trying to sell some stuff, and the morning after the first night of the festival, I was crossing the lobby on my way to go to a couple blocks up to Denny's and have breakfast, and she said she was there, and she kind of pounced on me and said, where are you going? I said, I'm going out to breakfast. You want to come? So we went up to Denny's, and I bought breakfast for her, and that's when she told me, well, this is the first I knew for sure she was in a relationship with Ramon. She said, he's kind of a bad guy, and I'm done with him. I'm going to leave him. But she says, there'll probably be another man involved. At which point, what I thought was, okay, here it comes again. Not the first time for me, but here it comes again. I'm going to be the older brother she never had,
aww,
shoulder to cry on, a support system, and then she'll find another bad boy mm-hmm. to go off to abuse mm-hmm. her, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's what I thought was happening.
Mm.
But I realized that I cared enough about her mm-hmm. after knowing her for a year, or a little more, you know, with the correspondence. It was a year and a half by this point. After knowing her for a year, and I really do care about her, you know, as a person and a friend. And so if that's what she needs, you know, here I am. You know, she can, I can be the support system, you know, and then she can pick another guy. But it just turned out, for the first time, really. I mean, I've been around this block before, but this time, you know, she was smarter than that, you know.
That's
wanted
great.
A different type of guy the second
aww.
Time around, you know. I can't
more
tell you
mature.
Her whole story, but he just passed away, Ramon. We visited him couple 3 years ago. He had a bad fall and was in a coma for months in the hospital, and he woke up and he was in rehab trying to, you know, remember where he lived and all this other stuff, and he was just kind of rounding the bend on this rehab. We actually visited the place where he was at, and I think the day we were there was the first time he'd actually gotten up and walked out of his room and down into the lobby and met us. But he did say to me, all the best to you, a couple of times mm-hmm. in his little English that he mm-hmm. could speak. So
how long have you been married?
Well, our 20th wedding anniversary
yes.
is in about 4 days.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so she moved here, and it was about two tourist visas where she was only allowed 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
First she came to visit me once. After what happened is that second year, as we began to fall in love with each other at that festival, and we did, you know. I mean, the morning at the last day of the festival, I had a new CD coming out, and I paid for overnight delivery, but I had it pressed in Canada. I paid for overnight delivery, but overnight delivery from Canada to the United States does not exist. They'll charge
mm-hmm.
you for it, but
aww.
But it's going to be held up by at least one day by customs.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of arriving on Friday, so I would have them to hand out to all the other magazines and
mm-hmm.
to sell a few copies to all the little distributors
mm-hmm.
that were there at this event, they didn't arrive until Monday morning when everyone's checking out of the
mm-hmm.
hotel. And Gabby and I had been up till 5 o'clock in the morning the night before, and I was asleep in my bed, and, you know, 9-10 o'clock when she was checking out of the hotel with Ramon, she called from the lobby. She says, I see your box here. I want some of those CDs.
Mm.
So I woke up, I got down, got my box. I gave her one for a magazine, and she bought six more of them, I think, for gifts for her friends back in
mm-hmm.
Germany. And then I ran into a DJ who was also a small distributor. I sold him five. I probably had about three
mm-hmm.
transactions like that, made up a little bit of the difference from
mm-hmm.
not having them for the whole festival.
Mm-hmm.
And she went off to travel the rest of the U.S. I think they went to Austin, Texas after that, and out to L.A., and they even had lunch with Earl Palmer, the famous DJ, the drummer from New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
who invented rock and roll, basically, on those early Fats Domino records and Little Richard records. So anyway, I wrote a song for Gabby, and I also wanted a picture. She's a better photographer than I was, and had a better camera, I think. And I was so busy trying to keep my eye on my stuff that I was trying to sell it. I ran up and take some pictures, but I was sure she had better pictures. So I called on the pretext of getting a picture for the cover of my magazine that she had taken. And Ramon answered the phone, and he said, "Oh, she's at work, but she'll be back in about half an hour. I'll have her call you." And I, you know, he didn't speak real good English, but enough to tell me that. And so she got home from work, found out I'd called, sent Ramon on an errand across the street. In the apartment building across the street was one of their major contributors, or another record collector, and she sent him on a spurious, an unneeded errand over there to get rid of him. Then she talked to me on the phone, and I sang her this song that I had written for her called "Sweet Little Boppin' Gal," and she said, "Well, I think I want to. You have the Rockabilly Ball in Seattle. I want to come to visit you and come to the Rockabilly Ball, but you know, I don't think it's going to go over very well with Ramon, so I'm just not even going to tell him I'm going until I leave." He found out and forbade it, and she came anyway, though. What happened is my son got home from the Army. He'd been in the Army for 4 years, and his last hitch was for a year, I think, or 6 months, a year, I think, in Korea. And he got home from the Army, and he and I were going to drive a car that my dad gave me, an old Chrysler 300, down to visit my folks. We'd take a father and son road trip. And this was just, you know, a few days before, like maybe 10 days or a little more than a week anyway, before she was going to come to visit. Well, the phone rings a half hour before we go out to the car, and it's Gabby, and she's on the phone, and she's crying. And I could tell that, you know, she'd been abused, you know, probably beaten. Mm-hmm. She's like, "I can't come, I can't come, I'm not coming." And I was so rattled that I didn't manage to bring my washboard. I had a gig on the way home at a festival in Eugene with Philae Gumbel. But I had a strong suspicion that she was going to do it anyway. She was just going to have to sneak out. Mm-hmm. And I called her the next night at work at her job from Eugene. And she said, I'm going to come anyway, but I can't, you know, I got to sneak some clothes and, you know, that I'm taking with me to the job, and I got to leave straight from the job to the airport. And she did come, and she visited me for two and a half weeks, something like that, and went to the Rockabilly Ball here in Seattle with me, and then she went back to Germany. And you know, and I was definitely hoping, not necessarily expecting, but hoping she would decide to come and, yeah, and be here, you know. Yeah. And I was pretty upset that she'd gotten, you know, beat. I guess this was the first time he'd ever done that, but, you know, thinking he was going to lose her, you know.
It's terrible.
You know, physical abuse, I mean, it was a fortunate thing that there were several thousand miles between me and him, because, you know, I would have wanted to try to do something.
Sure.
Whether I could have succeeded, I don't know, but anyway, so then I called her at work every day that I could, you know, every day.
Okay.
Talked to her for 10, 15 minutes on her break at work for 6 months, wrote two more songs, and sang those over the phone. And finally, she came in March, the following March. And they gave her a hard time in Atlanta. Her flight was through Atlanta, and the immigration there gave her a hard time for being a single woman who was, you know, 28 or whatever she was, when she came to visit, I think. No, her first trip here, when she was actually intending to stay. Of course, you're only on a 90-day tourist visa, and they gave her a hard time. They said, "A woman your age should be home having kids, shouldn't be traveling on her own.
We think
you're coming here trying to find a husband," which, I mean, there was a certain level of truth to that, but
that's what you already had.
But so when she had to go back after 90 days, she went back to visit her parents, and she came back with her mom and her sister, and said, told her mom, you know, to do the talking at the immigration, and just pretend she couldn't speak much English, and say a family vacation.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they didn't get harassed this time. And then when it was time for her to go back the next time, we just decided, well, we're getting married. Because we consulted an immigration lawyer, and he said, well, if she goes back, you're going to have to get a fiancé visa, it's going to take 6 months. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, she's going to have to be there for 6 months. She won't even be allowed back in the country mm-hmm. on another tourist visa. But if you get married, she doesn't have to go. Mm-hmm. So we just, I called up a buddy of mine named Jeff Jason, who's an old friend and also a musician and writer and photographer, in fact, as well. And I said, what are you doing Thursday night? He goes, nothing, I guess. I said, well, we want you to be the minister at our wedding. He said, well, I've never done that. I said, well, but you're Universal Life Church, right? You're qualified. And he goes, yep. And I said, we had it at my assistant editor's house. Him and his wife were our witnesses. My daughter made it. My son, although Perfect. He was in town, we didn't have, it was too short a notice. He couldn't make it. I don't know. He wasn't there, but he was at my first wedding, 3 years old.
So, a true love story.
Yes, it's really a nice story.
It is a lovely story. And you're such a lovely couple. And
yeah,
you're
had
making a living,
you know, Russell,
as a musician.
Russell plays the mandolin and at the market some days.
Oh, yes.
We were down there last week
She's
listening to our friend
Paula.
Walter, who's playing right now down there. Yeah, Russell and Paul. He leaned over to me and he said, I thought you guys were still mm-hmm. in the first blush of love. And I said, well, we are, but our 20th wedding anniversary
yeah.
is
oh,
coming up here.
Yeah, oh, that's sweet. You're known as the honky-tonk sweetheart.
Yeah.
And you're still making a living?
Yeah,
as a
in the process of calling her every day, you know, and thinking that she needed to be pretty far away from Ramon. If mm-hmm. she was going to get away from him, she had to be far away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think he did abuse, you know, beat her up a second time somewhere
oh,
along
no.
in there.
Oh,
only
no.
those twice. But and she probably wouldn't want that story being
public. No,
no, public,
okay,
you know,
okay,
but,
we won't do that. Please.
Although he's passed away now, so he doesn't have to live with that reputation anymore. But
well, we can edit it.
There was a certain point before she moved here, but it just dawned on me one day that it was possible, it was entirely possible that I actually am the best man on the whole planet for her.
Absolutely.
Because of the fact that we share so much common
you
interest, you know. I mean,
yeah.
that makes for a really good partnership, you know.
Yes,
when we both care about music so much.
Yes.
I knew she had wanted to play. She told me after she bought my book, she said she'd when she was 15, she'd taken the train 200 kilometers with her best friend, who we just went to the wedding of, up to Hamburg, and went to this big market and bought a tea chest. Over in Europe, they don't make washtub bases; they make tea chest bases. She carried that home on the train. It's a great big wooden box with a bulkhead in the middle, and built herself a bass out of it. And her friend played the accordion. They tried to start a little band called the Hopcats, and I guess they didn't. Really keep it together, and she and the friend got estranged because of this relationship to this guy, and the friend's father forbade her to speak even in class at school to Gabby anymore. After Ramon was out of the picture some years later, I mean, I heard the story, I encouraged her to get back in touch with her friend, and she didn't do it right away, but she finally did, and the friend just got married for the second time, and the wedding was what we went over for. The timing, I thank them for their timing because we got weather that was, you know, it was another week of summer.
It was.
More than a week. We were there for 10 days. All but two of those days were summer, you know, above 70, up into the 80s.
Well, that's a lovely story, and thank you. And you talked about a lot of the history of music in your life and your magazine, and I'm sure you have many more stories. It's hard to pick and choose.
Too many for you to. I've already given you too much to have to transcribe.
Well, it's really good. Thank you.
Well, more later when somebody wants to hear.
Okay. Any last thoughts on Duval? Or
I like this town, and
that's great.
I'm glad I stayed.
That.
Gabby likes it too. It's mm-hmm. Her parents have visited here. Several times and stayed here with us, or one time that we rented that house that Jeff and Amanda bought
mm-hmm.
from the previous owner for a month once, and they
mm-hmm.
came to stay, and they lived there.
Fun. Great. Well, that's great to hear, such positives too. I hear a lot of, oh, it's not the same and all that, but...
Well, it isn't, and I kind of miss, to a certain extent, some of the old-timers that I knew. I mean, several have passed away and stuff. I enjoy running into Alice Luchas at any given music event. Mm-hmm. She's probably down there listening to Walter right now at the farmer's market.
And so you probably want to go down.
Yeah, I didn't get to know her until much more recently, but I knew her son. One of her sons used to come and hear me play when I played at the cocktail lounge there, where the five-star restaurant now is.
Well, we'll check out and maybe do another one with more stories some other day.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.